This is Paul.
And this is Wayne.
Very exciting to have you guys back here. I have a bit of news that made my week, my long-awaited, long-fantasized-about Micronauts Omnibus hardcover of the original Marvel years arrived this week. And guys, it's glorious. It is beautiful. They have done a beautiful job scanning and recoloring. There's a bunch of bonus material here. I freaking love this book. I'm chomping at the bit to buy the ROM book. I haven't done that yet. And then in November, the Godzilla Marvel Omnibus, the original Marvel years, comes out.
Oh, I need to get that.
It's October 1st. They updated the date. It's October 1st. I'm so excited.
What I can't wait for is August, when the Marvel versus DC and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep looking at my pre-order emails and I'm like, when the hell does that come out?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because, I mean, it's crazy. I need all of these things. I am literally putting in a new shelf in my office to accommodate all the hardcovers I'm buying this year.
For guys who don't read comics physically.
Yeah.
Well, and that's going to be the thing, is these omnibuses are going to be hard to read because some of them are going to be huge.
Right. Well, and I am happy to report that they released it on Comixology. So my $110 book, you can buy digitally today for $39 on Comixology, which means it'll be in a sale next week digitally for, you know, $10 or less.
Yeah, because probably. I want the physical book to have and to have Same. On the shelf, and I want the digital to read because these books are – the bigger it gets, the harder it is to read because it's hard to hold.
Book. Yeah, it's not a book I'm going to read in bed, you know, which is where I do the lion's share of my read. So. Anyway, it's just gorgeous. I can't get over how well what a great job they did on incorporating all of this stuff. I've got it right here in my hands, and all the Michael Golden art is just amazing. I love it. So there you go.
Well, I'm very excited for you, and to Wayne's point, I'm very excited about those Marvel versus DC omnibuses.
Same.
You know, we got excited. We ordered them when we were talking about them, when they were first announced. And it's like, okay, now wait 6 months. And I'm like, damn it.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to it. You know what else I'm looking forward to from Marvel Comics?
What's that, Paul?
I am very much looking forward to this week. They announced that there is an upcoming miniseries that's going to be Alien versus Avengers. You know, they're finally taking advantage of owning both.
Mm-hmm.
In something other than a variant cover, and that they will be releasing a 4-issue limited series. I don't know when the release date is, but it is going to be written by Jonathan Hickman with art by Esad Ribic, who, you know, that is the creative team behind Secret Wars, years ago, and kind of a superstar team to put on this book, you know, kind of like they had superstar teams on some of these books in the past, like Batman versus Alien or Batman versus Predator and stuff like that. So, or Superman versus Alien. Here it is. July 24th is the release date.
You know, I'm not a big Aliens or Predator fan. Like, I haven't seen any of the movies, but I find I absolutely love them in crossovers. So like the Wolverine Predator was really good. Some of the Batman Predator stuff has been good. Superman versus Aliens was incredible.
That was my favorite of all of those, Superman versus Aliens.
Yeah. So I am excited about this. And I also did there was an Aliens novel recently that was by Scott Sigler that I absolutely loved. And I got just because I was a fan of the author.
I'm very encouraged by we kind of talked about this when the series first came out, but I'm really encouraged by the 20th Century Fox books that are coming out from Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
I genuinely enjoy the Predator series and the Alien series. Aaron, you said you're reading
Alien Red, White and Blood, and it is fantastic.
Yeah, we've talked about, and we'll be talking about later in the episode, the Planet of the Apes books.
Yeah.
And those have been really good, too.
Yeah.
This book sounds great. I mean, just the creative team.
I think there was a lot of concern when, you know, the Fox properties, you know, left Dark Horse, because Dark Horse had done such a tremendous job taking care of those properties, you know, since the 90s, for crying out loud. You know, those books have been around forever, and Marvel getting them and Marvel taking them seriously is huge. You know, they've had, you know, top notch talent working on all of these series, and every one of them that I've read has been really good.
Yeah, one of the issues I have with a lot of the types of books that are based on other properties is comic creators tend to go wild with them. I want the stories to feel like they're in that same world.
Right.
When a lot of comic creators feel like they need to go over the top because they can.
Right.
And I'm not seeing that with these Marvel versions of the books. They feel like they're in the same world. Yeah, there are some things they do that they couldn't necessarily have done in movies for budget reasons, but it doesn't feel like it is over the top.
Yeah. I'm reading the, so Entertainment Weekly was the one who announced the news, and they're like, it's set outside of the continuity for either Alien or Avengers stories, which gives some room to play. And I'm like, yes, I want to see a chest burster. I want to see a chest burster. Yeah. I want to see Wolverine with a chest burster and see what
that was my first adamantium thought.
Skeleton.
That was my first thought too. Wolverine with a chest burster, and then he heals from it, and the chest burster is like shredded by the adamantium skeleton.
Yeah. You kind of seen that though in X-Men with, you know, Wolverine versus the Brood.
The Brood, yeah.
You know, you've kind of seen that kind of thing. I'd be more interested, because it happens out of continuity, seeing some Avengers die. You know, show me the chest burst happen inside the Iron Man armor, right? Yeah. I mean, that, show me something just gnarly.
Well, I like, you know, I mean, the guy to write those books is Tom Taylor, and that, you know, he's a DC guy, but, right. Hopefully Hickman has that level of play allowed, you know, afforded to him.
Yeah, my only concern about Hickman is that he tends to get up in his head, you know, and his books are very cerebral. I feel like you've got to have a writer more along the lines of a Jason Aaron doing those kinds of things, because Jason Aaron is very visceral in his writing. You know, he's all about, you know, the guts and the gore and just the rawness of the emotion, which, you know, we'll talk about when we get to Batman Offworld. But, you know, I love Jonathan Hickman, and I'm sure he can do it. I just never see that from him.
You know, I have one of two things I would do if I were writing it, and it would be around Ant-Man. You would either have a chest burster from him while he's small, and then have
microscopic alien.
Yeah, or like ant-sized aliens running around everywhere, or a chest burster when he's giant man. And they have a giant version of one.
I think what we're saying is we want to see some chest bursts in this book.
Really? I want to see the entire Avengers lineup burst. Well, and just think about, like, you know, Monica Rambeau, you know, who becomes light, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work with an alien getting those powers? Because, you know, the aliens take on the aspects of their host, right? So, you know, that would be super interesting. What is that going to do?
You know,
if Thor, you know, bursts an alien, does that alien become worthy? You know, can it hold Mjolnir?
That's what I want to see.
Yeah. Sorry, Paul, you were saying.
No, it just occurred to me, you know, they have that Wolverine versus Predator series. I don't know if it's still being published. I never read it.
I didn't either.
Yeah. I guess I need to revisit that.
It wrapped up. I really enjoyed it because it was Wolverine. It wasn't like a one-time story. It was all of the times over Wolverine's life that he encountered this one predator, starting back when he was really young in Canada, all the way through to modern X-Men.
I guess I need to check it out. I mean, I bought the first issue and just never read it. So get me psyched up for this Alien versus Avenger book.
I'm down for it.
Me too.
I'm looking forward to Avengers versus Alien, and I'm looking forward to the inevitable sequel to it. You know, AVX versus Aliens. You know.
Yeah, AVXVA.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes,
give it to me. With the Brood.
Yeah.
Involved Brood versus BVA.
Yeah. Even better. Yeah. And some Shi'ar in there.
Yes. Starjammers.
Speaking of which. Wayne, are you caught up on X-Men 97?
I am.
Can I just say that with the spoilers, with the events at the end of the prior week's episode, the death of Gambit, I kind of thought this week's episode was a little bit of a letdown. I was not nearly as interested in this week's episode as I was in the prior.
See, what I'm noticing is they like to end on something major. Uh-huh. And then give you something different. And because they did the same thing when they were dealing with the Storm story the first time.
Right.
They end with something big and then move on to something else entirely. And yeah. Now they did the same thing. So the next episode, we should get back to the Gambit thing.
Yeah. Well, the timeline synced up at the end of this week's episode. Right.
Right.
You know, because you see Storm and the others see it on TV at the end of the episode. But I was just like, it's not, you know, you had me at the end of, you know, the Gambit episode, the Gambit Genosha episode. And then I was like, the storyline with Storm and Forge, while I really enjoyed the Barry Windsor Smith art back in the day, I did not care for the story itself. And yeah. I do not care for the story here.
I see the Genosha stuff was actually a punch in the gut.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. I didn't expect to feel things watching the show.
No,
and
no.
They made me feel things.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it was way out of left field. It's like, holy cow.
Well, and I have to say, they are doing some storylines so much better than the comics did.
Mm-hmm.
I, for one, am enjoying the Madeline Pryor storyline way more than I did in the comics. Mm-hmm. Now, I loved Inferno, but when you look at Cyclops yeah. doesn't come off very good in those stories.
Right.
He basically finds out that his dead girlfriend is alive and leaves his wife and kid, abandons them in Alaska. Where here, it's much more nuanced and you get to see him struggle.
Right.
I feel like we're getting the emotional payoff that we never did in the comics.
Yeah, I X-Men 97 has largely been produced extraordinarily well.
And I can't believe some of the things they're actually doing.
Yeah.
That they would have never done on the original cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's been very enjoyable with the exception of last week's episode. I was very disappointed in last week's episode. Spent far too much time with Storm and Forge.
Last week's episode covered one of the things I had been waiting for all this time. We knew Xavier was alive, and I wanted to see what was going on with him.
And I loved the Shi'ar stuff. I wanted more of the Shi'ar stuff. I wanted less of Storm and Forge.
And there were cameos there. We had Vulcan that was part of the Imperial Guard, and I always love seeing Gladiator.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the Shi'ar stuff and then seeing them fighting the Kree and all that, that was a hoot. I love the Shi'ar Empire. I love that era of Lilandra and Charles's relationship. All of that was great big fun. I just didn't care for how it was paired with the other. But I did like how the realization of what happened in Genosha lands with Charles. You know, it was that part was really good. Just didn't care for the Stormforge stuff.
I need to get caught up. I've actually only seen the first two episodes.
Oh, I'm sorry. We've spoiled some things.
No, I don't care. I do not. Trust me, the internet has already spoiled everything.
Yeah, I never imagined they would actually do some of these stories, especially like the Madeline Pryor stuff, that they actually dealt with it and they're dealing with it in a better way than I think the comics did.
Well, and I got to say, you know, Gambit going out, he went out like a badass. I mean, that was super cool. I was like, that is super cool. You've got people writing this show who understand the characters. I thought that was great. So, but Paul.
Yes, sir.
I watched me some Rebel Moon last night.
Okay. Yes. So Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, came out yesterday as of this recording. So Friday, April 19th.
Yeah.
You know, we had mixed feelings on Part 1. I think we didn't love it. We didn't hate it. We were whelmed by it, but enough interest to continue with the story. So, Aaron, how do you feel about Part 2?
A couple things.
Yes.
One, I wish I had had time to rewatch the first movie before I sat into this one, because they are really one movie.
They are.
That I mean, it's Act 1 and Act 2. They really should be viewed together in a full, what, four-hour viewing experience. Mm-hmm. And I say that because there are things that happen in this movie that they do not remind you of or explain, right? I mean, they expect you to recall what happened several months ago when you watched the first half.
Or just rewatch it, right? You know, like, it's readily available.
Yeah, it is streaming, right? But, I mean, you know, I'm not someone who's got that cavalier amount of time these days, so I just watched the second part.
Yeah,
I would have. I think it would have benefited from a rewatch of the first. I think I've got the same complaint that I had about the first one, in that everyone is so damn serious. It needed a punch up rewrite by somebody who can tell some jokes, right? Because everyone is just so dang serious all the time. And, you know, we've talked about this before. Humans are funny even in the darkest circumstances. And, you know, it's just super frustrating. And the thing that I was looking forward to the most about this movie was getting to see the Anthony Hopkins character, James, the robot. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see more of him because we saw so very little of him in the first movie. And yeah, you get to see a little bit more of him, but not a lot more of him. And I was really disappointed that he did not play a more major role in the film. All of that said, I liked this movie better than the first one.
I did too.
Largely because it wasn't a getting the gang together movie, which the first movie totally is. You know, let's get the gang together. And which I found a little formulaic and frustrating. This movie, again, could have used a joke or two. I dug the fight scenes. When we get to the war part of this,
the second half of the film is great.
Oh yeah, I mean, just all kinds of great blowing stuff up and fights, and you know, you're like, get out of that tunnel, you know. It's really very enjoying. In fact, there is a scene in the movie that reminds me very much of an Instagram feed I came across, where this guy is digging a hole in his yard, and he's like, you know, every day I dig a little bit more in this hole, and when we get to 1 million followers, I'm filling it with gasoline and setting it on fire. Oh, it's kind of like what this movie is. Yeah, I dug it. I just wanted more James, you know. And I will complain about there is a revelation at the end of the movie, and it's like, oh, by the way, revelation with nothing to back it up. And I'm not going to spoil it.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that. I'm like, wait, whoa. Yeah. I mean, you didn't even want to hint at that. And like, how do you know that without knowing where? Kind of, you know, not to spoil it, but it's like one of those things that it's like, how do you know that? You specifically.
And there is a turn also in the conflict that is not referenced one little bit in the movie. There is no preamble reference, because it follows up on something that happens in the first movie. So again, if you have forgotten what you watched in the first movie, or you didn't see the first movie, you are completely, you're like, who the fuck are these people?
You know what I'm saying? Now I know what you're talking about. I was like, whoa, okay, that feels totally random. And I will say, I think much like the first one, the second one falls victim to the removal of anything considered unnecessary to propel the story forward to the conclusion. Right. We know that there are director's cuts of both films coming up, I believe, in the summer. And I think I'm hopeful that they expound upon some of the storyline elements that, I mean, for what it's worth, both of these films, even though we're talking about 4 hours of entertainment, were literally trimmed down to the bare bones just to get you to say, here are the characters, they fight. Some of them die, the end. And that's what we got out of the 4 hours. But, you know, what little was left of character development and stuff like that, all was to our same as the first, very generic, you know, very exposition heavy and lacking any warmth or humor. And I think that's why once characters start dying, I didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there are a couple of the leads who die over these last two films where it's like, I feel like I should care more about that. But all I really know about them is, you know, the archetype character that they are. And so when they die, there's not the emotional impact that I believe that they want you to have. And again, I think a lot of that's victim of stuff on the cutting room floor. But even if, you know,
if you can't
even
then, I think if you can't tell your fucking story in 2 hours when you wrote the goddamn thing.
There's that.
I mean, that's
on you. You're Zack Snyder.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and I mean,
like, everything you're describing is standard Snyder.
It is.
Well, he and two other guys wrote this movie. So there are three people who wrote the screenplay. And but you're right. I mean, if you are the writer director, that's on you. You know, agreed. You had 2 hours. You knew what the limiting factors are. And again, I think a lot of this could have been solved with some funny. You know,
yeah, just a little bit. I think a lot of it could have been. Yeah.
Every Snyder movie is too grim, too dark, no comedy, and is much better with the director's cut because he can't edit worth a damn.
Well, you know, I would for what it's worth. And we both know I'm a Snyder. I'm not like a full-on Snyder bro, but I am a fan. I have found that Snyder films, that he has found a way to inject humor in his prior films, whether it's Dawn of the Dead or Army of the Dead. You know, there is some levity and some humor. And there's actually quite a great deal of humor in the Snyder cut of Justice League. But there was definitely not in here. And I think that is the quickest way.
It's the first thing he cuts.
Yeah.
When he cuts, that's the very first thing he's going to cut. So when you get your director's cut, you might get some humor back in there.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're dealing with. Because, yeah, to your point, it was either never filmed or it was cut. But that is what was needed to care about the characters, to have the emotional weight, and to make this a little bit warmer. But all that being said, I did enjoy part two more than part one.
Same.
I thought the last hour was not only a visual spectacle.
Oh my God, it was gorgeous.
It was gorgeous. Exciting. It was action packed.
The scenes when the dreadnought is coming into the system. I mean, I was like, God, I'd love to see this on a big screen because it was just gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, I do think James was underutilized, but underutilized. Yeah, way underutilized. But you know, I loved the mechs that came out, and
yeah,
there was a lot to like about this film. And yeah,
I think it would have been easy to hide the vehicle effects in all of the atmosphere on the screen, you know, because there's all kinds of dust and grit and whatnot. And when the first mech shows up, that's what I thought they were going to do. Is that they were just going to kind of hide it in that mess of atmosphere. But then you start getting a really good look at it and like, holy crap, you know, they really went all in on the special effects. Cause I was really marveling at what they did with the space scenes. And then the dogfight at the end of the movie, I was like, holy cow, this is great. I mean, he really developed, you know, a really strong look, I felt. For the world, there's a really sharp design aesthetic. I made fun of the movie in the first film because of the costumes. They were just so much aping Nazis.
Yeah.
That did not bother me in this movie. And I don't know if it's just because I had some time to live with it from the first one or if there was a different, sort of nuance. But there was this movie, the costuming didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, well, the one thing that I'll say about a movie like this, specifically this kind of movie that's trying to ape Star Wars so hard is, I watched, because Zack Snyder's kind of going through the media tour promoting this film. I watched a video on YouTube the other day where I think it's I don't remember the name of the channel, but it's worth watching, even if you're not the biggest. It's GQ. That Zack Snyder goes through his films like one by one, and he talks about, you know, a little bit behind the scenes, why he cast whom, some of the controversial scenes. You know, it's actually a pretty interesting video, and you know, he kind of goes through this lens of looking back. He doesn't talk about Sucker Punch, but he talks about most of his other films, like, yeah, this is what we did, this is why we chose it. You know, these are some of the, you know, things that it ended up with or some of the things that I would change. And I actually liked that about it. But he talks a lot about how in his films, which is very obvious, it's because he's done at least four comic book movies. He really leans hard into the iconography of the characters to, you know, like, I want this shot to be iconic, even if it doesn't make sense, right? I want these characters in these poses. He says, I hired Ben Affleck because the dude is 6'4", and he's 6'6", in the Batman suit, and, you know, he has that iconic look. Same with Henry Cavill as Superman. And I find that outside of the technology, that is something that was also missing from Rebel Moon, is that you did not have your Darth Vader. Right. Or your character, like your main villain was, you know, a Nazi, basically a right. Nazi looking dude. You didn't, you know, and they missed an opportunity when he dies and gets reborn in the second one to be reborn as maybe a cyborg or having right. some type of, you know, comic book feeling look to him. But the characters yeah. are all human.
I did not realize that he had become kind of a supervillain until he does that big, you know, flying jump and, you know, lands down on the knee with his hand down in a big superhero pose. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't understand that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, they had an opportunity to Darth Vader him up and they didn't do that. And I will say I was surprised that at no point in this movie did we get a shot back on the homeworld, right?
Yeah, not a single one. Like, they keep building it up, and I'm like, what is on the home world? Why aren't you going to show Bell? I mean, clearly he's setting up for more, but frankly, what I feel is going to happen is it's going to go nowhere, just like him his doing all the setup of the supernatural stuff in Army of the Dead.
Right.
I feel like we'll never get the further continuation of those stories, mm-hmm. or like Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Right.
You know, so it's a shame, but I liked what I saw. I look forward to the director's cuts for sure.
Yeah. I just wanted, you know, word to get back to, you know, leadership on the homeworld and then find out that the Scar Giver is on Veld.
Yeah, like Belisarius. They talked about him so much, but only showed him in flashbacks.
Yeah. But, you know, we got him in flashbacks in the first movie. But, you know, there is no at no point do we get a him, you know, getting a report, you know. And I mean, I watched through the end because I thought for sure that was going to be the stinger. Right. Yeah. And nothing.
Nothing.
And I'm complaining a lot, but I did enjoy the movie and I'll watch it again. I think I'm going to wait till the director's cut comes out and just watch all of it.
Yeah, right? I'd rather watch the best edition of the film.
Yeah.
In theory, the best edition of the film. So I will wait for the director's cuts this summer. I will watch them. Hopefully they're released simultaneously so I can kind of get one story. But I enjoy. Overall, I will say Rebel Moon for me was worth watching.
Yeah.
It is not. It is. You know, kind of, again, as a Zack Snyder fan, I find his Netflix films the weakest in his, you know, resume.
In his oeuvre.
Yeah, in his oeuvre. But, I've still found enjoyment in both of them. But they're not ones that, for as painful as this may be for people to hear, I find Man of Steel and, you know, probably one of his films that I revisit the most.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I watch it, I find that I enjoy it more and more, especially the Hans Zimmer music.
You know, you always add that cherry on top.
Yeah.
That's just a bridge too far for me, Paul.
You know, you got to listen to the soundtrack absent the movie. There's so much to enjoy. But anyway, Rebel Moon, I feel like it's worth the watch. You know, I get why, you know, if there are a lot of anti-Snyder folks out there, totally understand why his filmmaking style doesn't connect with people. And this is more of those things that you don't like, but I like them and I enjoyed the film.
Yeah.
But, you know, speaking of big budget action, you know, in the Superman books last week and this week, we got the first two parts of House of Brainiac. And, you know, we didn't record last week because I was out of town, but reading the first issue of House of Brainiac, I'm like, this is literally like if you have a Superman movie and then you have a sequel to a Superman movie, this book very much felt like, you know, Man of Steel 2 or Superman 2. Like, you know all the characters, you know, so they just like introduce all the characters and then bam, big budget, big screen action, you know, 10 pages into the first book. And I was like, woo, I am really liking the pacing on this book.
Yeah, I was immediately wondering a few things. I didn't know that Lana was Superwoman again. I don't know when or where. Yeah. I didn't know when or where that happened. I thought that had ended during the whole New 52 thing before Rebirth.
Yeah, they brought it back, but I don't know when or how. It certainly wasn't in any of the Superman books I was reading. It was probably in a side book like Supergirl or something.
Exactly. It wasn't in when they were first reintroducing the family and doing this whole big Superman family thing. So it caught me off guard that suddenly Lana was there, engaged to John Henry Irons and Superwoman again.
Yeah. Yeah. They like I said, they definitely don't. They're like, you know where everyone is. Here's, you know, we're just going to give you the bare minimum and hop right into the action. And, you know, two-page spreads of Superman flying over water with birds and over football fields. And then, and like I said, right around 10 pages in, frickin' Zarnians and Brainiac robots storm Metropolis.
And the thing that I love about the Zarnian element is, you know, we have always been told in part of Lobo's lore is that he is the last Zarnian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that's great about this story is, you know, for the longest time, you know, Superman was thought to be the last Kryptonian. And then we find that Brainiac actually has a city bottle, a Kryptonian city in a bottle, the city of Kandor.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out he did the same thing with Zarnia. He, you know, collected some Zarnians. I just think that's brilliant. And I love all the Zarnians just exploding everywhere.
Yeah,
I think that's a lot of fun. Absolutely
love it as a way to bring them in without taking anything away from Lobo.
Right.
He is not lessened in any way by not being the last Zarnian because of the way they were brought back.
Well, and in the second issue, they bring in Lobo and they turn it into a buddy cop. And,
right.
You know, like I said, I'm reading this book. I'm like, this is a freaking movie. Like Joshua Williamson is writing, you know, a Superman movie, because we've got this buddy cop element now with Superman riding a super motorcycle in space with next to Lobo in his chopper. I'm like, oh, this is so good.
Yeah, and I absolutely love Lobo's take on the Zarnians, that one of them was his hero growing up, that now and you even get like a Ric Flair type reference to be the man. You got to beat the man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that so much. And I do like the callback to Superman and Lobo being the last of their kind, because there's a novel out there that I read that was really good. That was a combination of Superman, Lobo and Martian Manhunter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dealing with them all being the last of their kind. And so it was kind of a callback to that for me.
I think this book is beautifully drawn. I think the story is terrifically told. There's all kinds of stuff going on. The entire Superman family is involved and engaged. And to your point, you know, here's Lana back as Superwoman. I can't imagine this goes well for her. There is a part of me that feels like she has shown up in these pages to be horribly, horribly murdered. I see bad things. I think that this is going to, I think the conclusion of House of Brainiac will set the Superman family on its ear. That's just a prediction on my part. But man, I am so here for this event book. It has been forever since Superman has had an event book that I've been really, really excited about. I kind of liked War World, the recent one, but it wasn't awesome. You know, there are some weak points, and I know we're only two issues into this thing, but man, these two issues are strong.
Well, and World lasted like a year forever. And a half, right? Whereas this is, you know, I think this is a 2 or 3 month thing, so that helps.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a minor part of the overall book, but I have to say, I really love Jimmy and Silver Banshee's relationship. I love the character. I've always loved Silver Banshee as a character when they explore her human side. And their relationship is just so, I don't know, refreshing to me. Yeah. I love seeing it on the page. I love seeing them interact. And I like seeing her get pissed when her man gets, you know, in danger.
Yeah.
Well, and I've never liked Silver Banshee, but I certainly like her in this relationship.
Agreed.
So.
Well, and anyway, I think one of the things that the biggest thing that this book has going for it, before we move on real quick, is that every issue is written and drawn by the same creative team, even though it's hopping back and forth between two titles.
Yep.
That I really appreciate.
Yep. No, I completely agree. The continuity there is fantastic.
Yep. So kudos to House of Brainiac, you know, Rafa Sandoval as the artist and Joshua Williamson as the writer, because I'm really enjoying the big screen action that they're doing with this crossover. It feels, like you said, like something to be excited about.
Yeah, and the artwork there is just terrific. I wish I could say the same about the artwork in issue 113 of Nightwing this week.
Yeah, I was bummed that, you know, so Nightwing issue 113, which is Legacy issue 300. So, you know, right. It's an extra sized issue and has a very beautiful few pages dedicated to Marv Wolfman and George Perez.
Yeah.
But the has a guest artist on it, Danielle DiNicuolo. But then they tease us by having Bruno Redondo, who's the regular artist, do two pages of the book. And I'm like, oh, this is the art I was hoping to see.
Right.
Because the guest artist is just a little too manga for me, I think.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you know, I know the Bat family is all, you know, dark hair, you know, white skinned characters.
Right.
But there are times I'm like, I can't tell the difference between these characters at all, between Tim and Dick. And then they had, and even a female character with short hair at one point, I'm like, is that someone is that Dick? Who is that? So, and Bruce, you know, he youngs him down a bit, the artist, or she youngs him down a bit. And I'm like, okay, I really can't tell the difference between these characters.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hated the artwork. I hated the artwork such that it really impacted my enjoyment of the book, though I did enjoy the Marv Wolfman, George Perez pages.
Yeah. And I think I think Bruno Redondo was taking a break because he is the artist of what's coming up next in issue 114/301 is we're getting the conclusion of Tom Taylor's run on Nightwing. You know, so I know you guys haven't been reading it, but Dick has been afraid of heights. Recently, they actually referenced it in this book, and you know, he's kind of no idea why, and I'm sure it's because there's something that's happening to it, maybe scarecrow gas or something.
Part of me was wondering if it wasn't a holdover from his brain injury.
And that's possible too. They have mentioned Rick Grayson quite a bit in the recent storylines. You know, they've called back to some things that happened during that time in his life. So it's possible. I'm looking forward to the conclusion of the arc. I love Tom Taylor. I like that he's getting, you know, a conclusion to what he's doing. I'm sure to free up some time because for, you know, whatever it's worth, we've got Absolute Power coming this summer in DC Comics, the big crossover from Mark Waid and Dan Mora. And who knows, you know, I think after that, we'll probably see a lot of relaunches and things like that. So that's, you know, I think that's why we're seeing some of these large, you know, these storylines come to conclusions over these next few months.
Yeah, I'm in for it. But boy, I just wish that the art was a little bit more stable and to my liking.
Yeah, this wasn't the best issue for sure.
But you know, I go right out of it when it's the manga style artwork. I can't even bear looking at it.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a book that is known for strong art to go so out of left field with its art style. Yeah. I did not care for it.
Paul, did you read Batman Offworld this week?
I have not. I've only read the first issue of Batman Offworld, but I know. I don't know. The first issue I was like lukewarm on, but I know you guys have continued with it.
Yeah.
So tell me about it.
It's so good. Wayne, tell him.
Yeah. So I am loving that Batman is basically, he's taken over a spaceship and is just going around like freeing slave colonies. And he doesn't have a crew full of people. It's just him and a dog and Punchbot.
Yeah.
That are on their own. He once again has a horrible relationship track record where there is this badass that wanted to be in a relationship with him.
Yeah, she's a Tamaranian, like Firestar. But Firestar?
Starfire.
Sorry.
But instead of asking her to stay with him, he asks her to fight with him.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, if you would have asked me to be with you, I might have done it.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love this book. I love the artwork. I love the storytelling, etc. But something, Wayne, something really bothered me this week.
All right.
We cut to Gotham City, right? And, you know, Batman is, you know, way off in the slag galaxy. It's a whole nother galaxy away. And the Gotham scene starts with, meanwhile, 26 million miles away. Now, Clearly, Jason Aaron doesn't understand space distances, but 26 million miles away puts you into the orbit of Venus. Not even close to being outside of our solar system, much less a full galaxy away. And that just bugged me.
It should have been a measure in light years, not in miles.
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Nobody caught this. And if it's a joke, it's a poorly told joke, right? It really, really bugged me. Really bugged me. But boy, I dig the hell out of this book. I love, you know, Batman being seduced by, you know, the lawlessness, you know, elsewhere in the galaxy. And he's like, well, you know, I need to get home to Gotham because Gotham is my thing. But there's so much injustice here that I can fix first. You know, I dig that. And the appearance of this new villain, the bad guy Thanagarian, you know, one of Hotman's people. This guy is super badass. I'm like, well, I'm going to need that action figure right away.
Well, and I love how you end the book with the Tamaranian sitting in the bar, hearing about the Thanagarian going after him. So, you know, she's going to come to his rescue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, the book is so good. It is just so good. And again, you know, Doug Mankey, you know, doing the artwork, it's so heavy metal. It's so badass throughout. I mean, I just keep hearing this thrashing rock music, you know, in my head as I'm reading this book. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so much action, yet there are still a lot of emotion to it as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I dig it. I highly recommend this book. So, yeah, good stuff. And Wayne, you and I are both caught up on Beware the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, and I want to say I called it the memory wipe.
Yeah.
I knew they had to do a memory wipe, otherwise they would mess with the original stories. Mm-hmm. But I like how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a memory wipe, but their subconscious still remembers and are influenced by it.
Yeah.
And they kind of are showing that the events of the original movies, some of their thoughts, feelings were all related to this story.
Yeah.
I got a kick out of that, how it tied it together.
I thought this whole story was expertly told. The device where they take images from the original Beneath the Planet of the Apes and Planet of the Apes comics and insert them as memories in the book, and even the newly implanted memories, you know, at the end of the book. I think this whole thing is great. I all of the characters are voiced appropriately. Zira sounds like Zira. Cornelius sounds like Cornelius. The book is just so well written. It's beautifully drawn. You know, the apes look great. The people look great. Even the gibbons look great, Wayne.
And we got gibbons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. An army of gibbons.
Uh-huh. This book was great. I really appreciate the thought that was placed into it. And Nova, who, you know, in the movies, in the original films, doesn't have a lot of agency. And she's got all kinds of agency here in this book. I really dig how, you know, even though she's mute and frequently seen as very passive, you know, she kind of takes charge in some scenes, and I dig that. I liked seeing that aspect of her character, but it didn't seem like a completely different character, right? It felt like these decisions and actions that were being taken were natural. If you like the Planet of the Apes stories at all, you cannot go wrong. Grab this book. It's fantastic.
Well, and I love in the original stories, she would try to stop Taylor from speaking. And, you know, you did see that she had some strength of character even in them.
Yep.
And I like here we get that she remembers all of this. They don't wipe her memory.
Right.
Because she can't talk. It doesn't do anything to impact the original series.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everything just felt so well thought out.
Oh, yeah.
Like no, it could fit in there as well as giving us something new. And just being enjoyable.
Yeah, it's very well considered. I thought it was masterfully told. So I highly recommend it. If you're an Apes fan of any size, shape or form, you know, whether you're a chimp, an orangutan or even a gibbon, pick up this book.
Yeah, I want to see what Marvel's going to do next with the franchise.
With the gibbons. We need more gibbons.
Yeah, I want more, because the last Planet of the Apes that they did was a more related to the modern movies.
Sure.
And now they've gone back to the originals. I want them to do more playing around with the originals.
Same. And Wayne, I know you're excited. We got the announcement this week that the Planet of the Apes role-playing game, it's a D6 system.
Yes, based on the old West End Games D6.
Yeah. I'm excited about that. I like that old D6 system. I am excited. You know, we were just talking about it. And by the way, that tip came in from one of our favorite listeners, Neil Dalton, sent me a note alerting me to that so I could share that with you guys.
Good job, Neil.
I know. We love our Neil deGrasse Dalton.
Neil Dalton Tyson.
That's right.
Yeah. I am so excited. I've signed up to get the updates as it comes out. I'm assuming it's going to hit Kickstarter because the company's previous games did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those Kickstarters I will be going pretty much all in.
Whole hog. Yeah.
Yeah. If there's a level where you can name apes or something in the book, mm-hmm. I will be going at that level because I love the idea.
Same here. I will be investing there as well. I'm super excited about that. I mean, it was just right on the heels of our earlier conversations about using your Planet of the Apes encyclopedia as sourcing material for an RPG. Yeah. So,
well, if you want more information, people, check out www.magnetic-press.com. No, we're not sponsored, but if they want to send us preview copies, we wouldn't say no.
That's right. And you can sign up right now to get on their mailing list so you get alerts as things develop. It's super exciting. Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, next week is a little bit of a slower week in ye old comic shops because it's a fifth week, gentlemen. Don't get me wrong. Marvel Comics is still releasing a Jonathan Hickman twofer. We get Ultimate Spider-Man issue 4 and the penultimate issue of Gods. Issue 7, so I need to get caught up in time.
I understood that it was a limited series.
Yeah, 8 issues.
Okay.
And Image Comics has a pretty significant couple of releases. They have the final issue of Duke issue 5 comes out. Looking forward to that. And Universal Monsters, The Creature from the Black Lagoon Lives. It comes out next week from Image Comics. Both are actually Skybound. The artist is Matthew Roberts, Dave Stewart does the cover. I'm not familiar, but it's co-written by Dan Waters and Ram 5. I have read it. You know, Image sent us preview copies. Unfortunately, I am under embargo to not talk about it.
You are forbidden to speak
forbidden about it. To talk about it. It's on. Yeah, we can't talk about it until April 22nd. But it's worth checking out. Is all I'll say. I don't think that breaks embargo.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, we want to know what you thought about this week's books. We want to know what you thought about Rebel Moon. Give us a shout at ideologyofmadness@gmail.com. And if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You should also hit us up on social media, IOM Geek, on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
What a deal. Well, hey, guys, let's get into our 5-week books, the few that there are, and we'll talk about all of those next week.
Catch you then.
What a deal.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.